Now, is there anyone here that can tell me why most alligators are abnormally aggressive? Anybody? Anyone? Yes, sir. You, sir.
Wait, well, Mama says the alligators are ornery because they got all them teeth but no toothbrush.
Yo mama said alligators are ornery because they got all them teeth and no toothbrush. Wow. The medulla oblongata is where anger, jealousy, and aggression come from. Now, is there anybody here can tell me where happiness come from? Anyone? All right, let's hear what Mama has to say on the subject.
Mama says that happiness is from magic rays of sunshine that come down when you're feeling blue.
Well, folks, Mama's wrong again.
No, Colonel Sanders, you're wrong. Mama's right, you're all wrong. Mama's right. Mama's right.
Something's wrong with his medulla oblongata.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to yet another episode of the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe. I am your curator, Sejan Serowick, and I'm here with my co-curator, Devin Decker.
Hello, Sejan. Excited to be here tonight for this cinematic gem.
And I am also so excited to be here. I apologize that I can't contain my excitement here, but we are talking about a true classic tonight, a turning point in the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe. We are talking about The Waterboy.
Ah, yes, The Waterboy, featuring Henry Winkler, Kathy Bates, and Burt Reynolds' best friend, Jerry Reed. If you'll just pardon me, I'm a bit parched. I'll take a sip from my Gatorade bottle.
Okay. Fuck that. Water all over you.
Oh, you gonna open up a whole case of whoop ass on me, Satan?
Gatorade.
Water sucks. It really, really sucks.
Oh, God. There has to be something going on in this movie where you get not just Henry Winkler in a starring role in this film, but also Clint Howard randomly.
Yeah. What? that is something that's in my notes, and we are far, far ahead of ourselves at this point. But, like, I was, like, good for Clint Howard because how often do you see him in a film not directed by his brother? But then I'm like, oh, but Henry Winkler's there. And that's, like, just Richie Cunningham adjacent enough to explain why he's there.
Yeah, man. So tonight we are talking about The Waterboy. This is our fourth outing?
Third outing? This is our
third outing.
Yeah.
Yeah, our third outing in the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe. And I was not kidding when I said that I feel like this is actually a really strong turning point. That is to say, not that I think this is our best go. I got some thoughts and some feelings, Dev, but where do we go from here? You're the guy with the structure.
All right. So I just want to explain what we're doing here, what the mission goal is of the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe. We are here. We join you every month to discuss the films that make up the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe, because somebody's got to do it, so why not us? Right.
That's what it says on the T-shirt. Yep.
And the most important thing is that this is very subjective. This is Sejan and I's global roadmap to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe. So your mileage may vary. But, you know, there were hundreds of almanacs back in the day. And if you don't know Sejan and I, if this is like the first time that you've heard us, we do a weekly show called The Say Report that focuses on everything. No topic is off limits. And here in the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe, we focus to the one, the only, the Sandler. And the universe, the interconnectivity of his films. And I have to agree with Sejan, like straight off the bean, that The Waterboy is definitely a turning point for the Sandlerverse. And it's appropriate that it's kind of our hump episode, that it's going up the hill, and next week we will officially be over the hill.
Yeah. But, yeah, man, I can't agree more. That exact thought crossed my mind as I was like, this falls at a really good time in our show's history. And I think that is like interesting the way that it reflects that it also falls at a very actually good time in Sandler's career as well. But go ahead.
Well, Yeah, you're not wrong, and we will definitely dive into that. But Seijin, what were your first impressions upon seeing this film now in 2021? What did you think about it?
I'll be honest. This is the one that I was, I think, afraid to go to the most, even more than, like, I know that we joke that Pixels is on this list, but, like, I'm excited to go to Pixels as somebody that saw that once, not completely in the dollar theater. Like, I think I came in 10 minutes late to it type of deal. Like, I'm excited to go into Pixels again and talk about it with you. Somebody that is, like, an advertised fan of that movie. But there's something about The Waterboy that I think that I fell prey to the same problematic views of Sandler films that the rest of the world did, starting with The Waterboy. And I think this is the movie that kind of causes a lot of the ripple effect going forward of people being like, Adam Sandler, offensive, dumb comedy, not my bag. And then they go back and watch a Sandler movie and they're like, oh, except for this one and that one and this one and that one. Right. And I had that feeling about this movie is I was like, this is like, I know we need to do it. I want to do it. Like, I'm in no way feeling like I can't take this movie. But, like, this was the one I was kind of cringing, waiting for the moment where I was like, right, that's the reason. Right. That's the reason. And I got to be honest, man, it never actually landed. I kind of had a decent time with this film. I don't think it's the best one that we've watched so far. I know it's not going to be the best one we're going to watch eventually because I got my own thoughts and feelings about what's to come. But, like, there is a memory of this movie being something that it actually, I don't think, truly is. Like, I think rewatching it, I was not prepared for the decent, just above middle of the road, like, comedy from the late 90s that this movie truly is. Like, it was a decent enough watch for a while, if that says anything, you know, high praise, but you know what I mean.
For a while. I really like, you have a lot of, no, that's what I'm saying. That's what I'm pointing to, is that you have a lot of qualifying statements in there, and yeah. I understand why.
Yeah,
is going to be not my rebuttal, but my admission of my first impressions of this film. So this is the third one. We've mentioned that prior to this, we've watched Billy Madison and Happy Gilmore, and we'll be following up this with Little Nicky, Pixels, and then finally Hubie Halloween. So coming into this, having not just, but recently watched Billy Madison and Happy Gilmore, my first impression was Adam Sandler's got one plot type that he really loves, and he runs it into the ground. And I think that's why, if I were to quote Robert Frost, two roads diverge in a yellow wood, this is the film where those two roads start.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are those films that stick to that, but then I think that even Adam Sandler himself is like, I can do other things.
Oh my God! Yes, you are segueing beautifully into me talking about what's going on this year in film. If you would so.
Oh yes, please. I mean, that's it. My first impressions were, this has always been like a background movie for me. I can't remember mm-hmm. the last time I've like consciously engaged in it. And there's a lot in there that I was kind of impressed by, but also a lot in there where I'm like, huh, that's an interesting thing to tie the whole messaging of this movie to.
Yeah.
But we will dive into those when we get to the back end of this episode. So if you want to hit us with those facts and figures, Seijin, roll them out.
So I would be remiss to not immediately point out that this comes out in late 1998. A year that for Adam Sandler, man, two roads was the perfect way of putting it. Adam Sandler chooses this year to be the year to begin his divergence from this style of film, because the other Adam Sandler movie that comes out this year, directed by the same director, is The Wedding Singer. A hugely different film from this, and one that we notably did not include in the Adam Sandler universe. But I had no idea that this and that The Wedding Singer and The Waterboy came out in the same year.
I had no idea that it was the exact same filmmaking team behind both films.
Yeah. Like, I I don't believe it was the same writer, because the writer that is on this with him is the same guy that wrote Billy Madison and Happy Gilmore with him, Tim Hurley. Hurley, thank you. And he goes on to do like Little Nicky and Big Daddy, and like, so he sticks to these films with Sandler, right? But the director of this film, Frank Caracci, who we get to see in the final moments of this film, by the way, he plays Roberto. but we he starts this year directing The Wedding Singer with Sandler, and then directs this with him, and then he goes on to direct a lot of Sandler's other works as well. He has his hands in I believe like Blended and things like that, and a good handful of them later. This is not the last time we will talk about Frank Caracci. But yeah, this is the year where we see for the first time Sandler split into two different types of actors. Now, noticeably after this, he goes kind of in the direction of sticking to what he does in The Waterboy more. We don't see him go back to what he does in The Wedding Singer for like 4 years. It isn't until he does Punch Drunk Love in 2002, right? But he does this. He does Little Nicky. He does Big Daddy, like year after year after year. This is also the year where we see Adam Sandler start putting the fucking work in. And now it should be noted that like he tried this in 96 when Happy Gilmore came out. That was also the same year that Bulletproof came out with James Caan and Damon Wayans. So like he did try to kind of break away from doing these, and that just kind of fell on its face. But like arguably like Wedding Singer is successful enough to merit a Broadway musical version at least, right?
I played the bass player almost in a local production of The Wedding Singer. We don't need to go into that story here, but I'll tell you on the Say Report someday.
Nice.
We're coming up on the 10-year anniversary of that train wreck.
It's also up against things like Saving Private Ryan has been out for a couple of weeks. Small Soldiers has been out for a few weeks. DreamWorks is having its fucking heyday right now. Although I say that, and then like number two this weekend was Ants. But you know, that is what it is.
I like Ants. I'm not going to apologize. I like the movie Ants.
And then you'll have to listen to our Ants podcast in the future. Oh, that's another thing for the Say Report. But yeah, so The Waterboy is coming out in this year, 1998. We're at the end of the 90s. We've seen what the 90s has become at this point, both on this show here, talking about Adam Sandler and how he's kind of shaped what comedy is. But also we've talked a lot on the Say Report about like the 90s was a weird time for film, right? And this is the end of it, right? And so we have this year where Sandler is in a position now, after two successful films, to make a decision. Is he going to go in one way or the other? And this film is the first film of his that makes its money back and more in the first weekend and goes on to be a certified blockbuster film. I have probably used that word in the last couple of episodes to talk about those movies, but like for the dictionary term of blockbuster, of like it made its money back double and more, like this is his first blockbuster film, and he makes his money back and more in the first weekend on The Waterboy. So it is no surprise to me that he kind of steps away from like the somewhat solid role, and that's not really a fair term, but I can't think of a better one right now, that he plays in The Wedding Singer and focuses more on doing this. I don't want to give too much away about my new rule at the end, but this is the year where he realizes like it pays to do this kind of comedy, right? And like and it becomes definitive for him for the next 4 or 5 years. And unfortunately, like I said earlier, I think it causes this effect. I think this is the moment where the rock hits the water, where we see for years to come people just looking back and saying like, I remember The Waterboy. This guy's kind of not my favorite. And I actually think after rewatching the movie, that's not fair, because The Waterboy is not the worst comedy, PG-13 comedy I saw in the 90s.
No, I mean, I'm not prepared to go like throw down the gauntlet for worst comedy PG-13 in the 90s, but it's something that I could have a discussion on. Yeah. I think something interesting about The Wedding Singer, I know you're like facts and figures guy, is that it just feels like it has such global appeal. Like, it feels like it's shooting for the lowest common denominator. And I don't have to look any further than, like, in Happy Gilmore, we talk about hockey and golf are weirdly having their heyday at the time that he makes Happy Gilmore. But yeah, two things that have always been popular in this country is wrestling and football.
And it's funny that you say wrestling, because I remember wrestling being a bigger part of this movie because of, like, Insano or whatever his name is in the beginning. Played by the Big Show. Fucking love the Big Show, not gonna lie. But the Big Show with long hair threw me for a loop for a second. Talking to a Farley brother, by the way, in that scene.
Kevin Farley.
But wrestling is not as big in this movie as I somehow thought it was. For some reason, I remembered it being a bigger part of this film.
But you can clearly see the fingerprints of wrestling on the character that Bobby Boucher is on the football field.
Okay, like, I'll give you that.
But even then, like...
The enforcer. That's what he is. He's the enforcer, yeah.
But even just that scene in the beginning with Captain Insano showing that wrestling is sort of the vice of the Waterboy. Like, his job is Waterboy, and when he has to unwind, he watches wrestling.
Yeah.
Like, you see how that shapes him to be the player that he is. And
I also take offense to the idea that he is a water boy in this film, because he's a water boy for all of 20 minutes. But anyway, but go ahead, keep going.
Well, it's the name of the movie, Seijin.
I know.
And we'll get to my synopsis where I'll throw in the years and all of that, and then I will be ready to fight against you with that discussion. But it is, it really feels like Adam Sandler had learned up to this point what was appealing to people and was ready to release that film that had global appeal. The movie just feels like Adam Sandler had been out there and seen what works and decided, I'm going to target everyone. So the fact that this is his first certified blockbuster is not surprising to me.
Yeah, I mean, just to give you like some really good solid numbers, just like, this is the thing that blows my mind. So The Waterboy comes out this week, and it comes out on November 6th. So, like, we're talking like Oscars season, right? Like, right. But it comes out and it scores $12 million on its opening day, right? Ants on that same day, which is number two, barely hits 1.2 million. So like 10% of what The Waterboy does. So this movie is not just coming out and doing gangbuster. It's also kicking the shit out of the rest of the films in the box office on this day in 1998. So like it becomes definitive for him for obvious reasons, and why he chooses to just kind of focus on this style of like of storytelling, comedy, character work, all of that going forward. But with that, Dev, I need a synopsis of this film.
All right. Okay. So, yes, the famous synopsis of the show. Sorry, I dropped it because I was excited when you gave that's crazy. $12 million. Crazy.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. So after 18 years in the job, Bobby Boucher, professional hydration specialist, has been fired from his job at the University of Louisiana. Defeated, he returns home to his mama, played to manic perfection by Oscar-winning actress Kathy Bates, who is more than happy to have her little 30-year-old beautiful boy back and safe at home, away from the dangers of the outside world, where she has deemed anything and everything that could take her son away from her as the devil. Undeterred, Bobby begins the search for another institution in need of his unique set of skills. This brings him to the campus of South Central Louisiana State University and face-to-face with Coach Klein, TV's Henry Winkler, the reluctant coach of their football team who is still nursing his shattered manhood after his life's work was stolen by a colleague 20 years earlier. After seeing the disgusting condition of the water Klein is serving the team, Bobby offers his services free of charge and a new partnership is formed. On his first day on the job, Bobby learns that whether he is providing water to the well-funded team of UL or the relative poverty of SCLSU, his position doesn't earn the respect of his peers, and the Mud Dogs treat him like a social pariah. The difference here is while Coach Red Bull U, Burt Reynolds' original best friend Jerry Reed, discouraged Bobby from standing up to the players when they treated him poorly, Coach Klein advises Bobby to stand up for himself or face the slings and arrows of their disrespect all season. Everything comes together after a player spits in Bobby's water cooler, and he chases him down and tackles him with the full force of a lifetime worth of persecution. Turns out Bobby Boucher may have been put on this planet to do more than just deliver clean and cold water to those in need. Now a college student, Bobby begins playing for the Mud Dogs while still trying to maintain his responsibilities as water boy. Soon a 41-game losing streak is broken, and the team is playing with renewed vigor to delight and pride of the town. Even the girl Bobby was sweet on as a boy, Vicky Valancourt, has come back into his life after being released from jail. Unfortunately, Red Bull U has a few more moves than in the playbook he stole from Coach Klein, and reveals that Bobby's high school transcript was falsified. To make matters worse, this reveals Bobby's football secret to his mother, who has herself hospitalized to keep Bobby from playing for the sake of her health. Luckily, Bobby has Vicky in his corner, and she convinces the town to come out and tell Mama just how much Bobby has been accepted and celebrated by them. Mama changes her tune, Bobby helps win the Bourbon Bowl, and we learn that if you never give up and put your mind to it, then you can do it!
Fucking perfect. Oh, God. Oh, man. Yes. Okay. So, I was going to say where to start, but I actually think I know where I want to start. I want to make sure that we give this its due for this episode. We got to talk about Vicky Valancourt for just a bit here, because I actually think she's probably, besides Bobby, who I by the end of this movie fell back in love with after a harsh dose of reality in the first few moments of this movie. I have to say that Vicky is my favorite. I think she comes out looking really good throughout this film, really powerful, and really kind of like, we talked early on about one of my new rules for us to focus on for like the Sandler verse. Like, one of the things that we really needed to remember going forward is that Sandler has this really interesting streak of having female co-leads, like romantic co-leads with him, that are actually like, you know, well-adjusted female figures that have their own power. Specifically, they don't depend on Sandler's character for validation as themselves. And I love that there is this sense of like Vicky is returning to his life, because, as you mentioned, right? But there's this idea that it wasn't because of anything that happened between the two of them. She goes to prison. And so her not being in his life and her reappearing is not a matter of just like, you're successful and now I'm back. It's that she's always had a thing for Bobby. And you never are, there's never a doubt in your mind that Vicky loves Bobby. And I something about that relationship between the two of them was so sweet that like the moments, the trailer moments, right? Like the trailer trash moment of this movie is Vicky opening her blouse to him, right? And that moment is earned in a way that I wasn't expecting it to be when I was remembering this film. And so like, I'm not going to forgive it. It is a weird moment. It is that we don't see in other Sandler films too often. We get close to it in Billy Madison with the whole like stripping when you get things correct scene. But this is the most blatant, just like, I'm going to be a female exposing myself to him, that we really have seen so far. And I think as far as Sandler verse goes, probably the most that we ever see. Well, one day we will talk about Chuck and Larry and that's a whole other fucking bag of bricks. But anyway, but the idea that she is very much in love with Bobby. She there's never a moment where she doesn't know who Bobby is. She knows exactly who Bobby is. And on top of that, like, Bobby knows who she is and loves her as well. There's nothing hidden between them. And she also helps him in so many ways in this movie. She works hard to be included in his life, and he has to like make a definitive decision to include her in her life, in his life. It is one of the most genuine on-screen like romantic relationships in these types of movies that I've seen. And I was honestly kind of surprised by how well it holds up and still is very sweet.
I don't want to like go too far down the line, but that's a real issue that I have with Hubie Halloween. Cause it feels like it's trying in a lot of ways to recapture the power of the water boy.
Mm-hmm.
And
in a lot of ways, but yeah, yes, in a lot of ways, specifically, right? Yeah.
But the relationship between he and Julie Bowen in that film is nowhere near as wholesome or believable as what I see from Vicky Valancourt and Bobby Boucher in The Waterboy.
And a lot of that is owed to Vera Zabalka. I want to get that name out there. Like, she really plays Vicky in such a sweet, believable way. It made me think a lot, very specifically, of Brittany Murphy and playing Luann on
King of the Hill.
Bobby. Okay, yeah, thank you, King of the Hill. Yeah, thanks. Yes, on King of the Hill, thinking of like playing Luann on King of the Hill, and the ways that how by the end of that series you realize how Luann truly is this like really sweet, deep character, and honestly one of the best parts of that show. And like, and Fruza Balk gets you there in a matter of just moments of being on screen.
Right. There's also this really nice moment that does a lot of heavy lifting, which is when Bobby tells his mama that he's a Virgo because Vicky Valancourt told him that.
Yeah.
I feel like she just told him that recently, too. Like, it triggers the flashback to the first time his mama said, little girls is the devil. And I don't think that that meant that he stayed away from her.
Yeah.
It actually, it sets a lot. It does a lot in terms of what the plot of this film is going to explore and how they actually interact with each other.
Yeah, in a movie that we are not going to talk about subtlety in any real form here on out, it is a truly subtle like detail, for sure.
There's a lot of weird subtlety in this movie. But do we want to do our patented something new, something old, something borrowed, something blue?
Yes,
before
please,
we begin exploring this film just a little bit deeper?
Yeah, let's go crazy. And you need to start this off because my something old and something new are actually tied together. So I need to make sure that they come out together.
Oh, excellent. That's not terrifying at all. So my something new, as much as I want it to be Rob Schneider, because this is the first time that he shows up in an Adam Sandler flick, my something new is witchcraft. I'm gonna stun everybody and say it's witchcraft being something that exists in the Adam Sandler cinematic universe.
Yeah, very specifically with the next movie, and then later on with Hubie. I didn't even think of that, but I love it.
Yeah, we bring witchcraft in because you hear Lynn Swan on the field asking Vicky Valancourt, who's going to win this game? And she says, oh, you know, it's going to be South Central 30-27. Oh, where'd you come up with that guess? It's not a guess. It's what's going to happen. Like, oh, okay, I get it. So you're a witch. Like, you're actually a witch, Vicky.
But also, like, very specifically, the ways in which Kathy Bates, am I saying that name right?
Kathy
Bates, I said like a mind freak. So the ways in which I'm literally staring at the IMDb page in front of me, I do not know why I question that, but anyway, the ways in which Kathy Bates blames everything on devilry and all that, and then the reveal at the end, because we I mean, this is not a huge spoiler, but the ways in which that we learn that that Bobby's father left her, right, is that he left her for a voodoo priestess, right?
Named Phyllis.
So this entire idea of devilry and witchcraft is something that really is actually kind of like raw for her, right? And so it's no real surprise that she has some issues with Vicky, not least of which because of this stuff, also because like she's like, Bobby, you can't touch anything outside of this house, but like that's something to talk about. But I wouldn't have even really thought about that, but you're totally right. This is something that ends up bleeding into a ton of other Sandler films. I mean, hell, you could even talk about Click in this way and talk, right?
Yeah,
and talk about Christopher Walken doing something to him.
Magic in some way, shape, or form is real within the Sandlerverse. And it actually is going to tie into my something blue, too. But I'll save that for when we get there.
Okay, so I'm going to do my something new and something old. And specifically because my something new is Rob Schneider.
Why do you think I go out there and I look, Sejin, for something so we don't just sit here with our hands, our dicks out?
Yeah.
Because we both have the same something new.
But you got it. So the crazy thing about this is Rob Schneider is in this film, and a year later, Adam Sandler is producing Deuce Bigelow for Schneider. So like there is... There's no doubt that like this is all happening together, right? Like he's showing up in this. Sandler also reprises this role in a weird way in The Animal a couple of years later. Do you remember that?
I do. Yeah, it's very weird. And it's why a lot of people, like, we're not the first. Like, one of the reasons we talk about this being our guide to the Adam Sandler cinematic universe is other ones exist out there. And at least two of the other ones that I've found in just my random researching do episodes on the animal because they feel it's so deeply ingrained in the Sandlerverse, and it's like weird because it's a parallel universe, you know, slide there, but I don't know if they exist simultaneously.
Yeah, I feel like the animal and the water boy are basically like that Sliders episode where red is green and green is red.
The pilot? You mean the pilot episode?
I feel like the only difference between these two universes is that like green lights mean stop. But there's this, so Rob Schneider being introduced there is huge. And in that, it's not just Rob Schneider. It's and this is what ties into my old, because it's not the first time that we've actually met some of these actors, but it is the crew. This is the first movie where you truly get the sense of the crew. And this kind of goes back to the rule that I kind of put in place from, I believe, episode one, where we talked about the idea that family is important to Sandler. And it's not just family within the film, although that is also on display here with him and his mom, right? But it's also the idea that family is important to Sandler in terms of like who he continues to work with. I mean, I already talked about the director of this film and the writer of this film, but this is also the first movie where we truly see the first time where Peter Dante, Alan Covert, and Jonathan Loughran are all on screen together with him. And that becomes huge going forward, but it's not the first time that we've seen them, right? Like Alan Covert, I praised a little bit in the last episode as the caddy, as the homeless, the homeless
Otto.
Caddy in Adams. Yeah, I love him as Otto. He's legitimately like one of my favorite. Like when I was a kid, I didn't want to be Sandler in Happy Gilmore. I wanted to grow up to be the kind of actor that played Otto in Happy Gilmore, right? And the same goes here. I love Bobby Boucher. Like I said, by the end of this film, I fell back in love with him as a character that I, for a hot second in the beginning, was kind of turned off by. But I instantly was just super into like Peter Dante as the jerk that eventually becomes the friend, or Jonathan Loughran in this film, who has this weird like going with it vibe, but is also the first guy on the team besides the kicker friend that he has. Yeah, besides Derek. Like Derek is with him immediately, right? Loughran's the first one on the team to kind of question Bobby, and who the fuck wouldn't, meeting Bobby initially, but he's the first one to come around to being like, "You're all right."
All
I can think of is the party scene with the fucking frog's legs muffins, and he's just like, "Weird, but okay."
I have a scotch and water, no scotch. Do you just make a joke, Bobby?
I love that. That moment is so good.
Yeah. He's genuine. And I also think that it says a lot because he's also the first one that Bobby tackles. Mm. So I feel like it's sort of a dominance thing, which we're going to talk a lot about masculinity in The Waterboy. But let's stick with our patented new old borrowed blue and finish it through.
So that's my new and my old. So my borrowed, I'm just going to throw this out there. I mean, it's the idea of the...
Why did I get to do my old?
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought... Go ahead.
No. I mean, I was going to do Alan Covert, but of course, I always have a backup. So many Adam Sandler, like, bits from his comedy routines and skits are the basis for this movie. Mm-hmm. Like, The Loneliest Kicker and Canteen Boy and... one more, the Cajun character. I can't think of the name of the skit right now.
But all I can think of is from the League, the Crawdad Man, the entire
time. Yeah, the Baba Man.
Yeah, but specifically, it was Paul Scheer's character in the Baba Man storyline where he's the Crawdad Man.
Right.
Just picking them crawdads.
but it's nice to see that, like, I think another thing where the Waterboy is important is that it's another example of Adam Sandler going back to his comedy albums and stylings in order to build a character. We hadn't really seen that with Happy Gilmore, like we saw with the buffoon coming forward into Billy Madison. And I think that's an important distinction with this film. And specifically, I mean, the fact that Adam Sandler is a writer on this one makes a lot of sense when you consider that as well.
Well, and this movie feels much more like... I don't want to say that he like trades off and like there are very definitively like people that you can go and look at their careers where they get to make the movie they want to make, and then they make the movie the studio makes them make, and that's like the trade-off, right? And you can talk about that with guys like Tom Cruise. Anytime he makes Mission Impossible, it's not because Paramount wants him to, God no, because he's probably going to kill himself one day on one of those. But for every Mission Impossible he wants to make, he then also has to go out and do like Alliance for Lambs and stuff like that, right? So like Sandler, I don't think he ever truly falls into that pattern. I think he makes enough money where he basically, and he starts his own production studio, so he doesn't have to answer to anybody, right? So I don't want this to sound like it's a trade-off that he gets to do this for that. But there is this idea that he gets to relieve himself on movies like The Waterboy after kind of putting a bunch of work in on something like The Wedding Singer, right? And we see that later in his career for like for every year that he has to kind of muster up the gusto to do something like Punch Drunk Love, he also has to get something out that year that is like Little Nicky or something, right? Like he's constantly within himself kind of giving himself this like this leeway to do a relaxing hanging out with my friends film, and that is very much what The Waterboy clearly is. It's clearly him in his comfort zone.
Yeah, as the saying goes in the Sandlerverse, for every Spanglish there's a grown-ups.
Right. As the saying goes.
As the saying goes. But yeah, drop your borrowed on me, because drop your borrowed on me.
I mean, it's obvious only because at the time we were still sitting in Forrest Gump territory, right? And that is The Beautiful Idiot. Like the idea of the dummy that is coming on screen that is capable of so much more than we give him credit for because his intelligence is so low. And that's not something new to cinema at all. I mean, that's been around since silent movies, right? Mm-hmm. But it is something that we kind of see in Happy Gilmore and in Billy Madison, but we specifically noted that they are underestimated to a fault because they are actually pretty intelligent. They're just choosing not to use it. This is the first time where no. This character is dumb. He's just very talented in a very specific way. So it's not like Billy, who is smart, he just doesn't apply himself. Or it's not just like Happy, who is actually very good at the sport he wants to be good at. He just doesn't, he can't focus. This is like somebody who's like, he's just completely off the rails. He has been ill-educated. His stupidity is not entirely his fault. Also, he is clearly stupid. Like there is a level to Bobby that is lowest. I mean, as you said earlier, lowest common denominator. That like there's no getting over that. It just so happens that he's just real good at hitting people.
I mean, you say that, but I had that same sort of light bulb moment with the character of Bobby Boucher. I mean, he is able to undo a lot of that, you know, basically like learned behavior of stupidity from like everything his mama told him. Like that he gets a 97 on the high school equivalency test is huge. But then to go a step further, when he shows up at the Bourbon Bowl at the end and Lonergan's character says to him, no one else in this room could have done what you did, Bobby. Like... Yeah. That's not a lie. That's not just him being kind.
No, that's fair. And I mean, and his moment with Coach Klein, where he turns around and uses on Klein what Klein has been using him the whole movie, is clearly a sign of intelligence. I think what it is more than anything is that if you had to put a scale out there of intelligence, which is stupid in and of itself, but if you were to put like Billy, Happy, and Bobby on that scale, Bobby would be the low end.
Yes, and that's just an unfortunate truth. But they're also the stuff that he knows about making water clean and cold. That's a skill. That's a learned skill that a lot of people don't have. Like he took his job as a water boy very seriously, and you can't deny the fact that he did that for 18 years.
Yeah, no, Bob, like I said, like I came around on this idea of Bobby because like when he's first introduced and you hear the voice and all of this other stuff that's going on and the physical mannerisms and stuff that Sandler applies to him, like honestly, it's a credit to him because like when he first shows up on screen, there is this like cringe moment of just like, oh, this feels offensive? But by the end of this movie, like you're in it. Like you buy into this character. You understand where he's coming from, why he kind of believes the things that he believes and like is the way that he is, and also are rooting for him. And also he kind of grows out of it by the end of it. So like for sure, like Bobby is this character that deserves more credit than he is given. And that's the plot of this movie. But there is definitely something for me where like Bobby Boucher is the first character that Sandler plays that is naive. That's that period. Like there's nothing beyond that. There's no qualifier. This is the first character he plays that is truly naive. We see him bring it back later with things like Hubie and stuff like that. But this is the first time where you look at his character and you don't think you're doing this to yourself. Everything that's been done to Bobby has been done by other people.
Yeah. He's an innocent. He really is kind of an innocent throughout all of it. And that's an interesting thing that we'll discuss further. But yeah, it is. I can't wait to get back to this because it's interesting. But talking about Borrowed, I feel like the scene where he takes the high school equivalency test, like three judges in a gymnasium, is just up and down cinema. My example part was Back to the Future, when Marty and his band try out and Huey Lewis tells them they're just too loud. But, you know, I wanted to get a little bit meatier, and this film feels a lot like It's a Wonderful Life to me.
Oh, okay. Okay. Keep going.
Right?
No, I'm with you. Let's do this. Strap it in. Let's do this shit.
It's specifically the scene where it is New Year's Eve, and Dick Clark is counting down, you know, to the new year, and all of the townspeople who had previously turned on Bobby because the falsified transcript as brought forward by the coach of the rival team for the Bourbon Bowl, like Vicky goes and she collects them all, and they show how him being there has had a positive effect on their life. Like, it taught them not to judge a book by their cover. It taught them that things that they think are limitations can actually be strength. It has this real feeling of no man in this world is poor that has friends. Like, the whole message of It's a Wonderful Life. And, like, right down the line to that Kathy Bates, his mama, the potter of the whole thing, like, coming around when she sees the value of, like, the outside world, and that it's not just money that makes a man rich. And, you know, she was so afraid of the outside world being dangerous and taking her son away from her, not realizing that the outside world can accept him and actually make him a better contributing member of society. Like,
and can care for him in a way that she was not prepared for the outside world to be able to care for him. Right. Like, and it's totally earned because of what happens between her and her husband. Right.
They're married.
Yes. Yeah. But but this feeling of like, I'm going to try and protect him. And then she protects him to the point where like he basically is injured in other ways. Right. Mm-hmm. For sure. Yeah. I am also. It's really hard for me to not look at Forrest Gump coming out just a couple of years prior to this film, and football being a huge part of the early parts of Gump's life, right? Mm-hmm. And like the idea of that, there's no way that they were not looking at that and also and while writing this movie, right? And so,
well, I mean, that's so, Ron Howard too, right?
Uh-huh.
Oh no, or is it Robert Zemeckis? Yep. No, that's Robert Zemeckis. That's a Zemeckis.
It doesn't matter though. Ron Howard was in the room.
Yeah, that's very true. But
Zemeckis
also,
making a movie.
You talk about Zemeckis. That's Back to the Future. It all comes together. It all intersects.
And I think part of that is like is how do you put trials and tribulations in front of a 30-year-old white male character that the audience are still going to feel bad for, right? Because at the end of the day, like we are slowly getting to a point where, especially at the end of the 90s, having a 30-year-old white male that's good at football and gets the hot girl by the end of the movie is how can we make people feel sympathy for him? Because it's a little hard at this point. Oh, I know. Let's make him an idiot is like a very easy like go-to. But anyway, like, but there is this idea that, there is this idea that what we consider to be important, right, is not what we thought it was by the end of the film. And that's definitely the message of something like It's a Wonderful Life. It's definitely the message of The Waterboy.
Yeah. I don't know. It just, I'm like, wow, that's some real big, It's a Wonderful Life energy. And when
I think
you
that
consider...
also ties into the whole thing where he's not a water boy by the end of this movie. The thing that he considers important at the beginning of this film, which is making sure everybody is properly hydrated, is not the thing he cares about at the end of this movie.
Right.
I have to say, I only just realizing that now. Sorry.
Go ahead. Completely understandable. Which brings us to something blue. And I'm very proud about this because it ties into my new, and that is his Alaskan glacier water that was blessed by an Eskimo shaman. I said that, and I just because I'm quoting the movie, I know it would be an Inuit shaman, so that it's always cold. Either the bottle that it's kept in or the liquid itself is the blue of raspberry lemonade Kool-Aid. I believe they call it ice Kool-Aid. I think that was the name of it. It is this beautiful shade of blue that I've kind of been chasing my entire life because it just looks so refreshing. And that's my blue for this movie.
I love it. That's a fantastic fucking poll. Yeah, because it shows up. Yeah, man. So this is one of those moments where I corrected my own notes, because at first I wrote Bobby, because in the first few minutes, like I said, in the first few minutes of this movie, I legitimately had to question whether or not this character was an offensive character for any particular reason. And by the end of it, I actually come around to it and thinking that no, I mean, you know, call me out for what it is and tell me I'm wrong on Twitter all you want. And I may very well be. But for right now, I actually came around to really liking Bobby and not finding him nearly as offensive as I thought I was going to be in the first few moments of this movie. However, the thing that I think kind of rubbed me the wrong way then was the way that Coach Klein is portrayed in having lost his kind of mind. And even that is kind of a stretch, you know, like in a lot of ways, like the ways that we talk about, like somebody being disconnected from reality is always played for comedy. But I think it's very blue comedy, the ways in which we see him, everything from sitting on the football at some point and having a quote unquote orgasm question mark, but also then later on, like when he first loses his mind, the reveal that he puts on heels is like supposed to be the thing, and they keep saying to him not that he has gotten his sanity back, but they keep referring it specifically as his manhood. You've got back your manhood, Coach, is like the running line with him in his arc. Is probably not something that would play nowadays. It is close enough that we could definitely tweak it to work in 2021, but what they say in this movie would not work in 2021.
Yeah, and actually, I'm gonna segue into the next segment of this right there, because I don't think you're wrong. I think the way that mental health is handled in this film is definitely some of the bluest comedy that is on display. Also, shout outs to Clint Howard's Paco trying to cop a feel from Vicky Valancourt during what could potentially be one of the most emotional moments in the film. Is that that's not necessary. Like, we don't need that. We certainly don't need that in 2021, and we kind of didn't need it then. But this film has a real stringent idea of what it means to be a man, and I'm not here for it. I do not ascribe to the water boy's rigidity in terms of manhood and how it's tied to being successful, how it's tied to like having like people who depend on you and people that you can depend on. And like, yeah, it's
a weird choice of phrase, because legitimately, if you took the phrase out and turned it into something else, or even just eliminated it and just reworked the scenes, the concepts all make sense. The idea that Bobby needs to find himself and be confident enough in himself to do A, B, and C are totally things I can stand behind. It's just tying all of that to the idea of quote unquote manhood make it super cringy every time they say it.
Yeah, I guess you'll never be a man, Bobby.
Yeah.
Like at the end of like, that scene you mentioned where she like flashes him. I mean, the thing that you have to constantly remind yourself during The Water Boy is that Bobby Boucher is 31 years old.
Yeah.
Yes. Like it is a constant. And I don't necessarily know why he's 31 years old. Like, because I don't believe that any of the other guys on the team our college age.
No. I think it is supposed to. I think the only reason it is introduced that he is as old as he is, that it is supposed to then be a shock why he is as immature and naive as he is. So he's not 22 and acting this way. He's 32 and acting this way, right? Or 21, 31. But like yeah. the idea that he is 30 something. Well, then he should have grown out of this a long time ago is the only possible response to that. And it's not a good one, but it's the only one that I have.
Yeah, because, I mean, the first thought that I have is, can you have a 31-year-old on your college football team? Is that allowed?
Yeah, no, of course it is. It's college football, as long as they're there and playing.
Are you sure? I couldn't bring myself to go down the bring it on hole from the Say Report, where like I actually learned and almost became a certified judge for like cheerleading stuff in order better understand. I couldn't do that for college football. So if you're a college student, you can do it. Like, there's no cutoff for age or professionalism, like.
I mean, there isn't in the NFL. Why would there be in college? Somebody could totally prove me wrong, but like I know that there have been stories of the older athlete playing. Now, granted, in college level, usually that story is like they're 25 and everybody else is 18, but like so 31 maybe not. But to my knowledge, no, there's no age cutoff. It's just so it's not a matter of like the college couldn't have him there. It's just a matter of like why would a college with access to a bunch of like 18 to 20 year olds that play the sport, why would they risk it on a 31 year old that's going to probably get out there and break his leg in the first game?
Yeah, I guess that's it. It's one of those, I didn't know if there was a rule against it. Because also you got to think, like a 31-year-old, like with like they're beating up children, kind of, if they're playing against like 18 to 20-year-olds. Like,
yeah.
It's Billy Madison throwing dodgeballs at first graders.
But how is that any different than Tom Brady playing now against the 18 to 20-year-olds that decide to not go to college and go straight to the NFL after right. they, you know what I mean? Like that happens, man.
No, I get that. But that's at a professional level. College sure. sports are, while it's supposed to be amateur level, it's not treated that way in this country. And I understand that. But. Yeah. It is one of those, it's that question that I have where, like, I don't know about the validity of this 31-year-old actually playing. I'm like, it's scenes of, like, oh, you're still technically in the fourth grade? Even though you're 21, you can be in our little league team. No, because there's an age cutoff, too. It's not just what grade you're in.
The more egregious stuff in this film, as far as like the rules of the college football go, is you can't show up halfway through a game and play. Like, you can't be put on the roster. If you didn't show up for the beginning of the half of the game, you don't get to play in the second half. I'm sorry, that's not allowed. Right. Like, that's the more egregious rules breaking.
Dude, and not just that. Like, there's also the fact of, I don't know if he would be able to enroll like halfway through the semester just to be eligible to play on the football team. There's a cutoff to when you can be offered that type of stuff. Like, sure. It's just this weird stuff that, like, you're not supposed to think about it. It's supposed to be this comedy thing. But, like, when you're throwing it in my face, his age and everything, so often, they throw it at you a lot because they want to make sure that you know he is 31, and that's why this is supposed to be funny. It's supposed to be funny that he's infantilized because he's 31.
Exactly right. You know what this movie is truly missing is it's missing that guy that Happy Gilmore had, who is the representative of the College Football Association. I can't think of the name right now. But
Trevino or
no. I don't mean like the person's name, but the role the
guy who's in charge of the golf league in Happy Gilmore.
Right. Yeah, in Happy Gilmore, where he says, "Look, I know he's breaking the rules, but he's bringing a lot of people to the sport." We kind of can't say no. This movie needed that, right? This movie needed that guy from the college football level to come in and be like, yeah, technically this guy wrote up his transcripts, or like, yeah, technically he tackled a ref or took his pants off in a story that we're told we never see. But like, apparently, technically, he like tackled a dude and threw him into the stands. But like, we're okay with it because he's really good at it. Like, it needed that guy. As unbelievable as that character can be sometimes, you need that as the justification as to why nobody else has walked in and thrown this motherfucker out of the game.
Well, it also, it rings untrue when the NCAA doesn't want you playing football anymore because of your transcript. And it's like, oh, all the other stuff is okay? That time that I just drop kicked a guy for like unnecessary roughness.
Handed him the ball, and then after he scored, drop kicked him. Yeah.
or like the power bomb that he does to the guy during the Bourbon Bowl, which would be immediate ejection in college sports. Or there's one other thing that, well, I mean, everything that we hear in those stories, but like you can't have it both ways. I mean, you can obviously because the Waterboy made a shit ton of money, but in terms of creating a believable universe, that takes the legs out from under it. Like, well, oh, and now they care.
And this is the thing that we were talking about, where the evidence of Sandler and in these types of films turning away from making the fun but still grounded comedy of Happy Gilmore, as much as you can say that, like, this is when it goes too far, right? For me, and it sounds like for you, but like this idea that these are the moments where it starts to go too far into the we're gonna let anything fly for the laugh territory, and that's not fun to me. Like, it still needs to be grounded in a reality that makes sense for me. And something about Happy Gilmore meets that. Something about The Waterboy does not. I don't know what that line is. It's like pornography. I couldn't tell you what it is off the top of my head, but I know it when I see it, right?
We are just full of cliches today, and I love it. And it's what really benefited from watching it again as an adult, like, and paying attention to it, because I had always remembered that after he tackled Colonel Sanders, he like kind of taught the class, but with the fake mama facts. And I just built that in my head because of that scene where he's showing that he's actually learning things in college, that he's taking advantage of his college education because he's in front of the class. I'm like, oh, now he's teaching them like the mama stuff. And I'm like, and that's ridiculous. Like, that's, why did you go that far? And that doesn't exist. But because this film is like just so uninterested in existing within the real world.
Yeah.
Like, it's so easy for the lines to become blurred as to what's really happening and what isn't.
Right. And I'm really interested to hear, just as like a sneaky preview for next month, but like how we feel about things when we talk about stuff like Little Nicky, because like it goes so far off the rails of reality, but in a weird way it's so far off the rails of reality that it's okay. Whereas like Waterboy, we're just talking about like college football, so like this is real world shit, so why is it not obeying real world rules, right? Yeah, this idea that the rules don't apply for the Sandler like cinematic universe, I think, is one of those things that ends up carrying forward, right? Is like at some point you ask the question, like, when do we adhere to the real and when do we adhere to the joke? And with these movies in particular, this is what I mean when I talk about it, like reaching out for the lowest common denominator, is like, it's always about the joke. It does not matter what the real world would say. If it's funny, we're going to do it in this moment. Don't think too hard is something that this movie really kind of leans into, and going forward for the Adam Sandler style really becomes kind of key for him for a while.
Yeah. There are no consequences in this film. Mm-hmm. And I feel like we talked about there not being consequences in other films, but this is the first time that it's happening in the Adam Sandler cinematic universe.
Yeah.
And just as it bothered me, and when we talked about it on the Say Report, something like Dick Tracy, removing the stakes is one way to like kind of make me disinterested in your film, but removing the stakes in a film where the stakes are kind of all you have, it's madness.
Yeah. I mean, well, and more to that point, we talk so much about how both Billy Madison and Happy Gilmore, there's a turning point in the third act of those films where the stakes are basically made black and white. In Billy Madison, it's the moment where he says, look, here's the deal. I'm going to do this triathlon, this academic decathlon, and if I don't pass it, I lose. But if I win, I win. So the stakes are just made like laid on the table. The tiger is literally put on the table in that moment. And the same thing happens in Happy Gilmore, where he's like, for my grandmother's house, this is what we're going to do, right? And this movie never truly lives up to that concept because the consequences don't matter. In those movies, the consequences are so clear. So it's like the wrong lessons were learned of like, they liked it when I went crazy with the sports stuff. And it's like, no. What we liked was how much you were using the sports stuff to fight for your grandmother's house. That was the important bit, right? And but in this, like the turnaround with him revealing to his mother that he's been playing football is like super emotional and heartfelt. And then less than 15 minutes later, it is resolved. It's over.
Yeah.
So like that is... It's heartbreaking in the fact that it's not heartbreaking.
It really is when you consider the films that we watched before this one had those moments where like, oh, wow, I'm getting jerked around and I didn't think my emotions were going to come out and play with this film. And then suddenly I'm weeping because of something that happened in Billy Madison.
Yeah, right.
Like,
right.
There's no moment where I'm like about to hit tears in The Waterboy, and they try to have their cake and eat it too with the comedy and the seriousness, but then like the next joke just has to already be queued up so that like you don't cry, you don't accidentally feel an emotion.
Yeah.
And it's strange.
Yeah. I mean, part of it is that this movie is 90 minutes long, including credits. Yeah, same thing I did. But that idea that like there's this movie also just kind of gets going, goes where it's going to go, and then gets done. And so like it shows up, shows you what it wants to do, and leaves. And I think part of that is that like Sandler putting on the most character-y character that we've seen so far in these movies. I wonder if they were like afraid to kind of overstay their welcome. And I get that, especially because, as I said, in the first few minutes, I was kind of feeling the same way. But like by the end of this movie, I'd be willing to sit through 10 more minutes of just character development, even if it was just 10 more minutes of just Bobby and his mom dealing with the aftermath of his reveal that he's been lying to her this whole movie. Where like the emotional heart of this film is supposed to be how much Bobby loves his mother, to the point where it is literally put up on the big screen at the end of this film. When like his big moment after he wins the big game, the first thing they ask him is, what are you feeling? And he's like, I love my mama. And they put it up on the screen. And it's like, I don't doubt that. I don't doubt that he loves his mom. But like, let me feel that, like, let me be in that feeling with him. Yeah, it's disappointing that they were not willing to go the distance with this movie that they felt like they were willing to go in both Billy Madison and Happy Gilmore. And I think this plays into what you were saying very early on in the episode, that this movie feels like for the first time ever he's playing it very safe.
Yeah. Ugh. And it's disappointing.
It is.
Especially, I mean, there's so many, like, I was looking for that meat. I was looking for that meat of those other ones. Like, the fact that they've both been lying to each other in order to, like, keep their relationship as mother and son as strong as they feel the other one needs it to be.
Yeah.
Like, that's some real deep emotional stuff that could, like, be dug into. But this movie doesn't really care to do that.
And to be clear, it is the script and the timing of this film that doesn't allow it, because otherwise the direction and the acting between Kathy Bates and Adam Sandler, like that moment when they're going through the journal and she's finally revealing to him the truth about Bobby's dad, who he thinks died early on due to lack of water, and he is learning that the guy actually just ran off on his mother.
Right, well,
like,
and that right, like, there, the fact that he's a water boy because his father died of dehydration in the desert. That lie set his entire path for his life.
And that moment is amazing. And if you take that moment out of the rest of the film, you watch that and you go like, this is good filmmaking. The problem is that once it's contextualized in the rest of this movie, it doesn't matter. And that is a crime. Like, that is actually legitimately a film crime. because you just get, you get, it's one of those moments that we've talked about in the past episodes of like, Sandler puts in the work on these characters. He goes into these emotional depths of these characters that are, yeah, okay, they're comedic, clownic characters, but that doesn't mean that they can't have emotional depths. History will teach you that. Only a fool thinks that, like, the clown on screen doesn't also have, like, some sadness behind him. That's the whole point of Pagliacci, right? there is sadness behind these types of characters, and Sandler is really good at getting to those moments. The problem is that this is the first movie where it feels like there is money on the table, there is money to be made, let's go in and get that money, and let's not risk a fucking dime. And this is the first movie that feels like that, and I feel like that is the thing that rubs people the wrong way, that they can't quite put their finger on about Sandler going forward. But I will give credit to Sandler in saying that he knows exactly what the issue is, and it is what is then addressed in something like Funny People years later.
You know who's to blame for this? It's Kurt Cobain. And oh. I know that's weird. I know it's weird that I'm bringing up Kurt Cobain, right? That's a shot from nowhere.
Shot's not the right word, but keep going.
Yeah, right? That just came out of nowhere. But like, we were weirdly conditioned in the 90s to believe that selling out was the greatest sin you could commit as a creative.
Yeah.
And The Waterboy is Adam Sandler selling out.
I can't argue that. Yeah. I mean, as much as I want to sit here and try and defend the guy just making his due, you're not wrong.
I'm not judging him for that. I'm not trying to but I think that's
opposite,
why.
Right. Right. Quite the opposite. It's that idea that Sandler finally gets the opportunity to sell out, and we see it as a sin rather than like he earning it. Right. Yeah. He earned the right to sell out at this point.
It's the reason why people look at this film and like, I don't really know if I like Adam Sandler films anymore. Is because societally we've been conditioned to feel that what he did with this film is not what you're supposed to do as a creative.
And
we fail, and like, this show wouldn't exist. We wouldn't be discussing the Adam Sandler cinematic universe if he had just continued to do that. Adam Sandler is intelligent enough as a creative to know that if I do the Spanglishes, if I do the grown-ups, I can continue to make the Spanglishes.
Well, and it's not just for him too, right? Like my kind of, not my final thoughts on it, because I do have a couple of other things that I do want to say. But like where I'm kind of landing on this movie is in that space of just like, I have personally noticed how important family is to Sandler at this point. And again, not just family on screen, but like taking care of his friends, being in these films with him and this group succeeding and being able to live lives and make movies and all that stuff together. And it's not just for him to be able to go off and make Spanglish. It's also for like Alan Covert to eventually get to do Grandma's Boy. It's also for Rob Schneider getting to do Hot Chick and the Animal. It's putting these guys in these positions where they can go out and kind of do the movies that they want to do. And those are the movies that we all know about. You know how many of these guys were also turning around and doing like indie films, just popping up here and there or showing up on television in certain roles just to like kind of like, because it's the thing that they always wanted to do. He's not just giving, that's the important thing about Sandler selling out. And I think part of the reason why I personally feel like I wanted to kind of do this was to not just talk about him getting to get to a point in his career where he got to do what he wanted and everybody should be allowed that, but also the idea that Sandler got to a point in his career where all of his friends and family got to do what they wanted as well. And this is kind of the first movie for all of them to do that too. It's why I made it part of my Something Old, that this is the first time you get to see the crew together, is because from here, they all get to go off and do their own fucking thing, but they always come back for a Sandler film because this guy is fun to work with and give them the opportunity to have the careers that they then got to have from here on out. This movie sets off a ton for a ton of these guys.
Yeah. This is an important film. It's hard to watch The Waterboy until you remember that this film is super important in terms of cinema and its relationship to Adam Sandler.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh, sorry, you got me there, Siege. I'm a little choked up. I'm not gonna lie. Which does bring me to something interesting. Do you think that Disney is kicking themselves for losing Adam Sandler?
I don't know. Did they truly lose him? Or I mean, like, they got him back for Bedtime Stories, right? Because before this, I don't know. I feel like what it is that Sandler hit a point in his career where he was owed to no man. And that's so rare that I'm sure Disney in some way is disappointed that they couldn't rope him. But at least they're pretty fucking happy nobody else did, right? Like, they didn't lose him to Paramount. They didn't lose him to you know what I mean?
And they kind of lost him to Netflix. I mean, Netflix has let him do exactly what he wants to do.
Yes. When we get to that point, we can definitely talk about that. But I feel like the world is kicking themselves for letting Adam Sandler get away to Netflix. Yeah. Because at this point, like, he gets to do whatever he wants. And now Netflix is pretty much guaranteed a solid 2 or 3 hits a year from him.
Right. I mean, everything that you're talking about, like, that's my driving question after you mentioned the crew and making these films for people is... Where that really starts to flourish, and as we'll see going forward, is once he pens that deal with Netflix.
Yeah.
And, like, when I watch The Waterboy, and it's a Touchstone picture, and it is Buena Vista distributing, and the sound and song clearances are from the Walt Disney Music and Sound Library, it's just like... Imagine if they also had Adam Sandler in addition to everything else that they have. And weirdly, I wonder, and this is grander scheme type stuff, and we'll focus it back down again, if their like hunger to like devour everything up that's successful will get the Marvel movies, we'll own Star Wars, you know, all this like collecting things together under the banner of Disney, I feel like it might possibly be fueled by missing out on Adam Sandler.
They're like, we lost the ball on that one. We're never going to do
it again. We're never going to do it again if we have the opportunity.
I mean, you're not wrong, because we've learned more and more and more about all of those decisions, how it really all came down to one or two people, right? If not for Kevin Feige, like the connection between Disney and the Marvelverse would not be what it is, right? And so, like, how weird is it to think that all it would have taken was just like a treating Adam Sandler a little bit differently as he was working with Touchstone, or the limited stint he does with Disney, and like they could have had him for life, and he chooses to instead go on his own and do the Netflix deal. Yeah, man. Yeah.
But
yeah.
We also talk about, and this will become far more important once we get to it, but like Adam Sandler kind of collecting up those that aged out of the Disney machine, and like, it also makes perfect sense that he would want to do that, considering he too was hurt by the Disney machine.
Well, and we say hurt. We don't know these things, right?
It could
legitimately be that he still has a very active relationship with them. It's just that he's in a position where he doesn't have to bend to the will of Disney. Do you know how important that kind of thinking
especially,
is?
Especially, yeah. There is shining a bulb on a frog's ass, because that's true. The fact that he's not beholden to them. But then I also think of like things like Hotel Transylvania being a Sony film and the connections that he has with them. Maybe he does have them. I was surprised to see that this was a Touchstone film.
Yeah.
Most of all because it's The Waterboy and you have those feelings about The Waterboy. And like, really, that's like Disney adjacent? Like, they live in the same trailer park, but, you know, he lives in the back, not the front part that you can see from the highway.
Yeah. Oh, man.
All right. Yeah. Sorry. So other things that you want to address about this one? Anything you think we missed about The Waterboy?
I got one last thing that I really need to lay out there, and it's my rule, but I want to wait if there's anything else you want to talk about before we get to that.
I think we are at that time where we chisel some new commandments.
Yeah, so allow me to go first, because mine's not that deep and it's pretty obvious and we've probably already talked about it a little too much already. But this is the first movie where Sandler learns that he can go low to like really hit the big bucks. And that ends up being something that we see going forward. This is the moment where Sandler learns, as far as the Sandlerverse is concerned, they're better off aiming for lowest common denominator, getting everybody into the room to enjoy and love the film. And then he can go off and he can do all sorts of stuff on his own. And this is the movie where he learns that, and it becomes, And this is the first rule that I'm introducing that I don't love. Like, this is kind of the first kind of bad knock against what I think is an otherwise pretty impressive like career. And honestly, it's a bad knock because of my personal feelings. It's not one from a business perspective. If I really think about it that way, he learned a lot from this movie, the fact that it hit as big as it did. But this is the movie where he learns that going low pays.
Yeah, and that's huge. Going forward, I believe we're going to see just how important that actually is until eventually maybe he goes too low and breaks his back. And I'm excited to explore that. And I don't even know if that happens. It's just a thought that crossed my mind.
Yeah.
I don't have something that leaps to mind to prove that right now, but it's something that's there. Like he can go low. He proves that he can go low, but is there a point that's too low? And well, we know he doesn't not recover. But you know, maybe it's a longer time in traction than we were expecting.
yeah.
I mean, honestly, that was one of my big rules as well, in terms of laws of the ASCU, is the fact that this combines everything that's popular to create something, and it proves that that works, that appeals to an audience, appealing to them on every level. Like,
yeah.
He gets that. He gets that feather in his cap, and it's important going forward. But I think if I had to add a law here, the Waterboy proves that you don't need someone to embody evil in your film.
Mm-hmm.
As bad as Red Bull U is, because I would argue that Jerry Reed's character is kind of is the biggest villain of this film.
Oh,
he not only hurt Bobby by firing him at the beginning, he also, you know, affected Henry Winkler 2 years before Bobby
Coach
even
Klein.
Got there.
Yeah.
Like those are big important moments, but also his mama is sort of a villain as well, with the way that she protects him and like the almost Carrie's mom-esque way that she is afraid and just like dedicated to fighting against the devil.
It's interesting that they split the antagonist into two big characters in this movie, and one is much more of an obvious antagonist, and the other one is much more of a like subtle like mental antagonist in his mom. It's a weird amount of subtlety again in this movie that doesn't ever ask for it anywhere else.
The subtlety in this film is incredible. It's overwhelming, the subtlety of this movie, if you really like wanted to go through it with that fine-toothed comb, because there's so many little moments that it's just like, oh, okay, why didn't you explore that deeper? Because that's the stuff I would want, because I've seen you do it in other films, Adam, but he doesn't need to in order to make a successful film, which this film proved. But it's more, we just need conflict in the movie. We don't need an Eric Gordon. We don't need a Shooter McGavin. We just need obstacles for our characters to overcome. And that is a entertaining enough tale that people are willing to go on with us. And I think that's important because, like, faces of evil are a big thing prior to this film.
Yeah. Man, it's the Water Boy, right?
Yes, I know. It's the Water Boy. You can buy it for a dollar more than you can rent it.
Yeah.
I didn't get that at all. That really blew my mind when I'm like, I can rent it for three or buy it for four. I think I'm going to buy the Water Boy. I now kind of own the Water Boy.
Yeah, it's digital. Don't worry. At some point, it'll get taken away from you.
Hence the
kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah, but man, I am very happy that we are doing this, and I was so happy to be watching this movie. I at no point felt like this was a job, and I think that that's something that's been really interesting to me so far, especially because this was the one where I thought this was going to be the slog, and maybe I'll be super surprised with like Little Nicky or Pixels or something, where I'll feel like, oh no, this one was hard to get through, but this was the one I thought was going to be, and it ended up not being as bad as I thought. And with that in mind, I'm so excited to go down the rest of this rabbit hole with you.
I have to agree. The Waterboy was one that, after Happy Gilmore turned out to be more of a slog than I was expecting, just because of its weird similarities to Billy Madison. Like, it didn't differ enough. And I talk about how, like, there's a pretty, like, common plot structure through all of these films. problem introduced in the first act. Second act, we get to have fun and we think the problem's overcome. And then the break into three is something happens that undoes everything in the first two acts. And then the stakes are finally established.
Yeah.
And like that's exactly what it is. It is Red Bull you're coming forward and saying you faked your transcript, and like he didn't, which is so weird. It's like there's just enough different with this movie from that plot structure that Happy and Billy follow to a T, like almost to their detriment, where the fact we're like Bobby didn't do anything wrong. Coach Klein did something wrong.
Right.
And,
yeah.
And Bobby, because he has matured so over that weird second act that is just like skit, 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 funny, funny, funny joke, he is willing to be like, well, then I need to own your mistakes because if I don't, my life will be changed. And I now have that emotional maturity to do what's necessary, or at least try to do what's necessary to make this right. And it, yeah, I don't know. It's,
yeah, no, man. I'm,
it's,
yeah.
It's the water boy.
It's the water boy. Fuck, man.
Forget his Seijin. It's the,
we didn't even talk about the baby head, and that fucked me up.
Oh yeah. Yeah. There's a good thing to end it on, right? Is the special effects that morph people for the visualize and attack stuff is so good for 1998.
They must have at some point had Kathy Bates in a football uniform, right? Like there's the only way they could have morphed to that guy turning into her would have been to also have her there and like go between the two. Like with the baby head, it's pretty obvious they're superimposing a baby head onto Jerry Adler.
Jerry
what's his
Reed.
Name?
Jerry Reed. Jerry, Snowman. Yeah, yeah. From yeah. Smokey and the Bandit.
But they're very clearly putting a baby head on Jerry Reed's body. End of story. That's funny. Comedy is great. With the Kathy Bates stuff, or even some of the Henry Winkler stuff. And the thing that got me was when it was multiple Henry Winklers. I did not remember that. And when it happened, I had to take a moment to catch my breath.
Yeah. It's
I like this movie.
I mean, and that, you know, it's real interesting. And I feel like we're in the wrap up, but still interesting stuff. Is this coming out during award season? I have to imagine the fact that they like Oscar winner Kathy Bates in The Waterboy.
Like, I mean, Clint Howard, we joked about him being in this movie, but that motherfucker was in Apollo 13 before this. Like, you know what I mean? Like that dude is no stranger to being in the award winning film that he just happens to play a side character in. And here he is with fucking Alan Colbert.
Yeah, the you fact that he's there is no higher praise to Alan Colbert than the fact that we're gonna put you as Clint Howard's buddy, like
straight man. You're gonna be Clint Howard's straight man.
We believe that you can handle this role.
Yeah, yeah,
It's. And also Henry Winkler, like coming in. There's another new, like this is the first time that, and it's just, it's seeing all of these moves that Adam Sandler, I'm going to heap some praise on him right now. It's making these connections in Hollywood, and he's so all about family. So that like, it makes sense that he would make these connections in order to make deeper connections down the road. Like, I feel like this is how you touch base with Burt Reynolds to eventually do The Longest Yard. Is you have Jerry Reed in a movie.
Yeah.
Jerry Reed's last performance is in The Waterboy.
Man.
It's
I gotta say, like, go out, put it on a Sunday afternoon with a drink in your hand. Like don't pay attention for too long and you'll enjoy yourself with this film.
Yeah, if you're missing football, The Waterboy, weirdly a good substitute. Mm-hmm. Just don't think about the rules too much. But honestly, who thinks about the rules that much with football these days?
Not Tom Brady.
You know what? Speaking of Tom Brady, you've mentioned him a couple of times. It's real weird every time that they're like, either he's a hero or he's a goat. Like, it's so weird that Tom Brady has taken back the term goat from being like the person who messed up on the football field to being the greatest of all time.
Yeah.
And one other thing, speaking of family, it's interesting that in these first three films, we have one where it is Adam Sandler and his father, Adam Sandler and his grandmother, and then Adam Sandler and his mother. That he has explored all of these familial relationships that I think clearly meant something to him when you look at something like Happy Gilmore and he dedicates it to grandmas.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Like, there's no, like, it just supports your argument of family. And it's something that I thought of and I wanted to make sure I got out there. So, yeah, at this point, anything else that you want to add?
Just going to come back around to Vicky Valancourt just being awesome. But Vicky other Valancourt. Than that, no.
Vicky Valancourt's awesome and introduces witchcraft into the Adam Sandler cinematic universe. And that's important. And we're going to see how next time around. That'll be in April. You can hear us talk about Little Nicky if you want to prepare. But until then, if you would like to talk to Seijin about, I don't know, the worst PG-13 comedy you saw in the 90s, you can find him online at Siege versus the World.
And if you've got some other Jerry Reed classics to throw at Devin Decker, you can catch him at Devin D. Decker on Twitter.
That's a 10-4, good buddy. All right. So thank you very much for joining us as we explore the Adam Sandler cinematic universe. And until next time, remember, we have no idea what we're doing. Good night, folks. Thank you so much for listening to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe podcast. If you like what you heard, you can subscribe so it's delivered straight to you. And why not write or review? If you want to get in touch with us on Twitter, we're at the ASCU. And you can always send an electronic mail to Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe at gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening. Apologize to your mother for me. And we'll see you next time.